You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Ukraine prepares for elections this weekend, and they'll be held in the midst of intense Russian information operations. Estonia's experience with such interference may hold lessons. A Magneto vulnerability just patched could compromise pay cards on e-commerce sites. Huawei reports record profits and comes in for sharp British criticism over slipshod engineering. Prisoners in Finland will be helping train AI. I chat with Lori Craner. She's director of Carnegie Mellon University's SciLab Security and Privacy Institute. And security companies hungry for talent should take note of tech layoffs in the larger IT sector. From the CyberWire studios at Data Tribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, March 29th, 2019. Happy Friday, everybody. The first round of Ukraine's presidential election will be held this weekend, with a runoff, should one prove necessary, scheduled for April 21st. Ukrainian elections have been subject to Russian influence operations for years, most notably in 2014, and direct hacking has also been a matter of concern. The Ukrainian Election Task Force, a monitoring group, seems cautiously optimistic that the vote will go off as planned and will result in a credible outcome. The task force notes that, unlike some other neighboring countries they might mention, voting in Ukraine actually matters. They also note that Russian influence campaigns have been focused on the election for some time. Moscow's general line has been that Ukraine is a violent, dangerous, radicalized place where groups of government-inspired thugs, bandits, will beat you, assault your wives and daughters, and burn down your house should you show up at the polls with the wrong candidates in mind. But such is the actual commentary from Russian government-controlled television shows on Russia One TV. The Russian radio and television are widely consumed in Ukraine, where most speak Russian, and where the closely related languages are for the most part mutually intelligible anyway. Russian information operators have been active online as well. According to the New York Times, one new tactic designed to circumvent social networks' efforts to cull inauthentic accounts has involved paying Ukrainian citizens to allow Moscow's trolls access to their legitimate Facebook accounts. The Estonian experience with Russian attempts to meddle in elections is being cited as an example by stories published in Quartz and elsewhere. The Estonian response has been complex, but in outline, it involved wider adoption of technical defenses against hacking, assistance to political parties and candidates with network and account security, anti-bot sweeps, and finally, public education in media literacy designed to induce skepticism and resistance in the face of disinformation. Security firm Sucuri has a proof-of-concept exploit for an SQL injection vulnerability in the core of the widely used Magneto e-commerce platform. They disclosed it privately to Magneto, which has prepared a patch. Access can be gained without the need for authentication, the researchers say. The risk to consumers is card skimming. As Ars Technica points out, the vulnerability is so potentially lucrative that criminals can be expected to exploit it in the wild as soon as they have the means to do so. About 300,000 e-commerce sites use Magneto, and all users are advised to apply the fix Magneto has issued. ZDNet reported earlier this week that some criminals were apparently using a weakness in the PayPal PayFlow Pro integration with Magneto to test stolen cards for validity. Much pay card data traded in the criminal markets are unsurprisingly outdated or simply hoaxed up, so the hoods will do a bit of testing. Magneto urges businesses to upgrade, lest they lose their PayPal access. Huawei, bellwether of China's tech sector, continues to receive a mixed reception abroad. The company is defending its security record as it reports annual sales of $100 billion. The EU has finessed security concerns about the company's participation in 5G networks. Australia and the US are unrepentant in their wish to keep Huawei out of their own networks. And the UK has harshly criticized the company's failure to remediate security issues. The Register characterizes Huawei's efforts to address known router vulnerabilities as half-arsed. This is an industry term, should you be unfamiliar with it. It means roughly poorly prepared and badly executed, and it often connotes both indifference and lack of effort. Wired expresses the current mood about risks surrounding the company's products as a feeling that it's not the back doors, but the bugs that matter. We heard similar sentiments expressed last week at the 3Cs-focused CyberSec DC conference last week. And finally, correctional authorities in Finland have an idea for training artificial intelligence. Have prisoners answer questions and use their answers to make the AI smarter. The country's criminal sanctions agency has contracted with AI firm Vainu to provide the inmates labor to the project. It's seen as a win-win-win. The jailers keep their charges busily on the road to rehabilitation, the prisoners get learning and self-improvement, and the machines get smarter. Or at least, street smarter. It's an alternative to the manufacture of automobile license plates that former guests of governors tell us is the traditional occupation given to those whom the courts have offered a period of reflection. But a lot of other stuff has been made in prisons, too. Packaging for various consumer products, processed meat, belts, and handcuff cases for police forces, even for a time in the 1990s, lingerie. Our corrections desk tells us they once knew a guy who taught a university extension course in ethics to a student body composed of long-term residents of a Midwestern penitentiary. His account of class discussions and consultations during office hours suggests that some of the models the AI will receive may be, shall we say, unrepresentative of the norms of natural intelligence. Anywho, the folks doing a nickel or so in Helsinki will look at the internet and answer questions like, does this article talk about a business acquisition? The same question would be posed to a large number of inmates, and their answers in the aggregate will be used to converge on a right answer to help train the artificial intelligence to do a better approximation of natural intelligence. We might suggest other questions perhaps suited to areas of local expertise because, after all, learning is learning. Consider, is this guy an undercover narc? Does Charlie have a shank on him? Is bologna on the menu today? We note that the sample question is basically a true-false one with a binary solution set. Could AI also be trained using more complicated multiple-choice questions? Perhaps even nested sequential questions? Consider, is this a convenience store? If it is a convenience store, that's a place where you can A. buy smokes, B. shoplift smokes, C. jackpot the ATM, D. all of the above. Stuff like that. If we may end on a more serious note, we've seen stories this week about layoffs on both U.S. coasts. Salesforce, Oracle, and PayPal are all downsizing their workforces. A lot of people with transferable skills are going to be searching for work, and the security industry around both San Jose and Baltimore might do well to give them a look. Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative.
With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Ben Yellen. He's a senior law and policy analyst at the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Ben, it's always great to have you back. I saw an interesting story from Columbia Journalism Review, and this is about law enforcement organizations using encryption on their radio communications, and some folks not very pleased with that. What's going on here?
Yeah, so Dave, you and I are located in a pretty high crime city, unfortunately, in Baltimore. And the way most reporters in Baltimore get news of impending crimes or crimes already in progress is by listening to police radio, the police scanner. Mm-hmm. This is free open source for most police departments. Generally, you can access it online or through various apps. And it's a key tool for journalists. Because, you know, if they are listening to the scanner, they'll hear about the initial response to an incident, and they themselves can get out to provide transparency as to exactly what's happening. What we see now, what's mentioned in this article, is that a bunch of different law enforcement agencies across the country, this was an article about law enforcement agencies in Colorado, are encrypting those radio communications, and that means journalists cannot access them. Now, there are legitimate reasons to want to encrypt these communications. It could provide a tactical advantage for officers to not have the public be able to figure out where certain police officers are going to be deployed. I think that is a very legitimate concern. But there is a First Amendment problem as well. Journalists aren't able to provide transparency, accurately cover crimes and other police-involved activity if they're not able to access these scanners. So I think it's a problem that's going to present itself as increasingly as more police departments use this encryption device. I mean, from their perspective, you can certainly understand why they'd want to keep these communications private, unavailable to the public, especially if criminals themselves are reacting to what they hear on police scanners. But it would be a major blow to journalism and to transparency to have this tool removed.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, because one of the aspects that they point out here is the privacy of victims of crimes who very often will have their names and personal information read out over these radios by necessity for the police or first responders. So there's that privacy component of it as well.
Yeah, and certainly that's a very compelling privacy interest. I think it's incumbent upon media organizations to work directly with police departments so that they can monitor the scanner and have informal or formal agreements in place not to release personal information. And just anecdotally, I mean, I follow a lot of different crime reporters here in Baltimore. All of them seem very responsible about not revealing the identity of victims or perpetrators, and being somewhat circumspect about identifying location and not asserting something as true without it being confirmed by a source beyond the police scanner. And I think there's, you know, generally a good practice among larger mainstream media outlets to treat the police scanner as sort of a rough sketch of what's happening. There are a lot of false reports. There are a lot of false leads. So I think the future solution to this problem is to have journalists work closely with police departments to protect that personal information while still giving them access to real-time crime updates to make sure that the public is properly made aware of what's going on in their community. And, you know, as an extension, I think it is potentially dangerous to permanently encrypt those communications as a matter of policy, because that's a drastic solution to this problem of revealing individual private information.
Is there any legislation that that swings either way on this, either requiring that law enforcement agencies keep these communications in the clear or specifically allowing them to encrypt?
The one piece of legislation that is cited is just a proposed piece of legislation. That is by a representative in the state of Colorado, a Republican representative who has introduced a House bill to prohibit law enforcement agencies from using encryption. He says that the use of encryption should not be ritualistic, but should be only used in extraordinary circumstances. So far, that bill has not been enacted. That legislator proposed it in the last session of the Colorado State Legislature. It was bottled up in committee. You know, and I think there is a tendency to give deference to law enforcement, particularly when it comes to these tactical issues. And I think obviously they have a large sway over state legislators. You know, I don't see a quick legislative fix to this issue of encrypting police radio communications.
All right. Well, it's one we'll keep an eye on. Ben Yellen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
My guest today is Lori Craner. She's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Computer Science and Engineering and Public Policy, and director of their SciLab Security and Privacy Institute. Earlier in her career, she served as chief technologist at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, was co-founder of Wombat Security, and served on the board of directors for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She joined us from Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
We have lots of security and privacy work across departments. And, you know, each department runs its own programs, hires its own faculty. But we formed SciLab because we wanted to have a way of coordinating all these efforts and bringing people together to collaborate. And so through SciLab, we're able to coordinate. We also have some larger collaborative research efforts that involve people across multiple departments. And we have some collaborative space. And so we have people all sitting together from engineering and computer science, all sitting side by side in the SciLab space.
And so what's the focus on security and privacy? Why is that an important area for Carnegie Mellon to make this sort of investment?
Well, security and privacy are increasingly important as more and more things go online and our world is increasingly digital. Protecting security is critical for our infrastructure, for everything. Privacy is also something which I think has become increasingly important both because there are more privacy threats out there now, but also there's more privacy regulation and needs to comply with privacy laws. And so there's a lot of research needed into what are the best ways to protect security and privacy. So this is a really important area for research. There's also a big need to hire people in these areas. And so Carnegie Mellon is doing our best to produce lots of excellently qualified graduates who can go out into the security and privacy workforce.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that a particular area of success for Carnegie Mellon has been encouraging women and minorities, people of color, to participate in the program. So you've seen some really some numbers that you can be proud of.
Yeah, we've been working really hard to improve the diversity of our computer science and engineering programs more generally, as well as in the security and privacy area. So our undergraduate computer science program is now 50-50 women and men, which is really amazing and has come a long way.
And so what's your take on the notion that we have this shortage of qualified people in the security industry?
So it seems that we do need to educate more people in this area. And the number of women and minorities in the security area is just ridiculously low. It's much lower than computer science in general. I just got back from the RSA conference, and you know, you look around and you just don't see that many women there. So we're missing out on an opportunity. You know, half of our population is not really considering this as a career choice. So that seems like kind of an obvious place to go to try to increase our ranks.
And does that outreach extend back to high schools and middle schools, trying to create that pipeline into universities like yours?
Absolutely. I think people are ruling out certain careers, you know, in elementary school, middle school. And so if we can spark that interest among middle schoolers, we have a much better chance of convincing them to enroll in technical programs later on. And so there are many great efforts trying to encourage young girls and people of color at those lower age levels. At Carnegie Mellon, we have a Tech Nights for Girls every Monday night for middle school girls in the area. We're also running this cybersecurity challenge for middle school and high schoolers called PICO-CTF, and we have thousands of students around the world are participating in this program.
What's your advice to folks out there who want to encourage young women and people of color to pursue these sorts of careers in security? What sorts of things can they do to make that an easier pathway for them?
Yeah, I think part of it is to have mentoring and role models and help women and people of color see themselves in these types of careers by seeing examples that there are diverse people in these careers. We also need to make sure that we take down barriers and remove some of the hostility that there's been in the past. I've been to security conferences where it was hostile to women there, where I definitely felt very uncomfortable being in those situations. And that was a few years ago. And, the good news is that I think things are changing, that I think when I go to security conferences now, I do feel a lot more comfortable there. And I think a lot of efforts are made to make sure that these are more inclusive environments, but we still have a ways to go. So at Carnegie Mellon, we have a master's program in privacy engineering, and this is actually the only program like this anywhere in the world, where we're actually educating technical students to take on privacy engineering roles, which are becoming increasingly common at companies, especially in light of GDPR. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was in Carnegie Mellon, we have a big focus on the human side of security and privacy. We have a course on usable privacy and security, and we have a lot of research which combines the core technology of security and privacy with the social science and psychology and human side of security and privacy, which is really important.
That's Lori Krainer. She's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Computer Science and Engineering and Public Policy, and she's director of their SciLab Security and Privacy Institute. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.